This podcast is part of a special series on science policy and commentary from Science Magazine.
Welcome to a policy podcast brought to you by Science Magazine. 40 years ago, Janet Rowley discovered that the abnormal chromosome, the Philadelphia chromosome, found in patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, CML, was in fact a chromosomal translocation, ultimately changing our understanding of cancer and revealing it to be a genetic disease. Janet, when you reflect on your discovery, what do you think?
Science is a continuum. David Hungerford, when he was a graduate student, discovered the Philadelphia chromosome using cells provided to him by Peter Knowle. Through my looking at cells from CML patients, I saw that the Philadelphia chromosome wasn't a deletion, there was a translocation. Others identified the Abelson gene and understood its function when there was no idea that it had anything to do with anything except causing leukemia in mice. All these things came together. And ultimately, when it was discovered that Abelson was a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, then Nick Leiden, pharmacochemist, and Brian Drucker, a physician scientist, could work together to develop Gleevec and treat patients in a remarkable way. Did I have any idea that that was going to happen when I showed the translocation? Not at all. Different pathways of scientific inquiry came together to give an absolutely marvelous answer.
So what led you to do these experiments?
Curiosity is what led me to look at chromosomes, because we had new technology available that could allow us to identify precisely the chromosome abnormalities that were apparent before the development of chromosome banding, which was in 1970. So pre-banded chromosomes, you could see that they were abnormal, but you didn't know what was going on.
And did you go into this looking for what you found, or were you surprised by your discovery?
Well, for CML specifically, I was looking at the late acute phase, which had many chromosome abnormalities, and I wondered whether any of them were consistent or whether they were all random. So that's what I was focusing on. And in the process, I discovered that the cells had an abnormal chromosome 9 with extra material at the end that was just like the missing material from the Philadelphia chromosome. I'd previously discovered another translocation between 8 and 21, so this raised the possibility that the Philadelphia chromosome was not a deletion, as everybody had assumed, but that it was a translocation.
Was it obvious to interpret what you saw?
Oh, yes. Because I was looking at cells in the late stage, it was possible that the translocation was a late stage disease. So these people had the Philadelphia chromosome in chronic phase, but I could go back and see that they had the same 922 translocation at the very beginning of their disease. And I, moreover, could look at some of these patients in their peripheral blood and see that on standard chromosome analysis, they were perfectly normal. So it wasn't a genetic abnormality that they had from birth. It was a somatic mutation.
And was it difficult to convince others in the field that chromosome translocation could actually cause cancer, or was there further work that needed to be done to show that this was the case?
There was further work that needed to be done, because neither the 821 or the 922 was present in what was then defined as a particular disease. So it wasn't present in 100% of the patients with the disease as it was defined in the 60s and early 70s. I found the 1517 translocation in APL, and that appeared to be unique to that disease, and all patients with the disease had the translocation. But what really was important was the coming together of the data that we had in translocations with the studies in viral oncology of RNA tumor viruses, and the identification that the tumor viruses really had unique genes in them that had been picked up from cellular DNA, and that's what Mike Bishop and Harold Varmus got the Nobel Prize for. And when translocation breakpoints were cloned, the first one in 1982, the aviral oncogene was found to be at one of the breakpoints. And when the translocation in CML was cloned in 83, 84, again, it was the Abelson virus that was found to be at the breakpoint. This really validated both tumor virology and cytogenetics as having something to do with human cancer.
How did that change things?
Each one validated the other. The fact that, you know, what did translocations do? Well, this discovery of the cloning of the breakpoints made it clear that recurring translocations in a particular disease ended up activating, in the instances I've cited of viral oncogenes, what were human oncogenes that had been first identified in viruses, but then other genes such as BCL2, which is related to programmed cell death, was also identified, and other genes involved in cell growth and differentiation, so that the genes that were identified at chromosome breakpoints were very critical genes in cell physiology. And so it was apparent that they were usually the initiating process in malignant transformation.
And what studies do you think we need to do now to make more effective cancer-treating drugs?
I think that we still are very ignorant of most of the function of components of the cell. When you think that only 2% of the DNA codes for protein, what does the rest do? Well, we know about microRNAs and some other things, but there are many aspects of long non-coding RNAs. What are they doing? We know of a few long non-coding RNAs that coat genes. Does every gene have something that coats it, that regulates its expression? We don't know that. So I think that supporting continued basic cell biology is absolutely critical, because some of these systems in cell function may well be abnormal in cancer and therefore targetable, and we're ignorant.
Wonderful. Janet Rowley, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Read Janet Rowley's Perspective, a story of swapped ends, in our June 21st issue. I'm Meghna Sachdev. On behalf of Science Magazine and our publishers, AAAS, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a policy podcast, part of a series on science policy and commentary from Science Magazine. The full Science podcast is released Thursdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.